I want to talk about after the Great Recession, and particular reference to the U.S., although I think there are lessons to be learned about the issues, there are obviously recession issues in the economy more generally, that we can glean from this. You know, there was a Great Recession. It ended 3 years ago. I want to talk about what's happened since, because as we all know, unemployment's still high in the U.S. We've gone through a period of the highest unemployment, sustained unemployment, since the 1930s. We call it a Great Recession in the U.S., in part because we avoided, you know, double-digit unemployment rates, but Europe's not avoiding those. And there is a major issue about the European case in terms of, you know, just nomenclature. All right, I'm going to talk about this in using the framework of flow labor market analysis, which is the sort of framework that Diamond, Pissarides, and I were honored with the Nobel Prize, in part because it is the tool that has become common usage, and it's the one that, of course, I know about, right, being a creator. So the flows approach to unemployment analysis, I'm going to try to explain what that is about and why it's insightful, and then I hope to demonstrate that it's insightful by taking you through from using it as a lens to understand the Great Recession, and then as quickly as I can, and then as well continue to talk about what happened afterwards. The impact on the young, unfortunately, that's a section of the talk that I would like to talk about more, but I probably won't have time to get to, all right? But it's a very extremely important issue, both in the United States and in Europe, about what's the impact of a very prolonged period of high unemployment, stagnant labor market, on the future of young people. And, of course, I suppose I can't avoid saying something about government policy, which undoubtedly will be part of the more controversial part of my comments. All right. The main point about the flows approach is to understand that you can't think about the labor market without thinking about dynamics. Unemployment is not a stagnant pool of people who can't find jobs. It is a circulating pool of people that are looking for jobs. All right? And that's the essence of the sort of flows approach and dynamic. There are people finding and losing jobs all the time, whether the market is in recession or whether the market's in a boom, and I'll illustrate that explicitly by giving you some numbers. To understand the from the point of view of this lens, there are always unemployment people and vacant jobs at any moment in time. They represent basically the period it takes to match the two. All right, it takes time. All right, it takes time because there's information gathering going on, for example. Where are the jobs? Where are the available people? And there's it takes time because once that part of the meeting takes place, there's an issue of evaluating whether this particular worker is the right person for this particular job. And vice versa, whether this job is two-sided, whether this job is the right job for this particular person. All right, so it takes time to form mutually acceptable matches. Again, the difference between a boom and a recession period is that during recessions, it takes a lot of time for the worker to find the vacancy, while as during a boom, it takes more time for the firm to fill the vacancy. Okay, so you get this opposite side effect. So the other point is that employment, or I'm talking a lot about unemployment in this, for this particular purpose, unemployed or just workers who want to be employed, who are not yet, is a stock of workers that tends toward a level that balances the large inflow of hires with the large separation outflow. All right, when the two are equal, all right, then there is a dynamic equilibrium, at least in the sense of balance, between in the level of the stock. Think of it as a bathtub. All right? As you're turning on the water, the level goes up. You turn off the water. All right? You have a level. Until you let it out, then you have an outflow, and it falls. All right? Now, what's going on in this particular bathtub is there's always people flowing in and flowing out. All right? Only when the two are balanced will the level stay stationary. And then the sort of basic point I want to make tonight is that movements in employment reflect movements in job openings for the most part. It's the flow in of vacancies looking for workers that moves unemployment or employment over this cycle. All right, here's a diagram which illustrates some of what I'm trying to say. The first point is understand the diagram. Along the horizontal, it's pretty obvious. We're talking about our months in specific years from January 2000 to January, 10-year period, January 2012. All right. For each month, there's an observation, which is in blue, which is the number of people who flow into new jobs. So it's a higher flow. And the red is the number of people per month who flow out, who separate from jobs. Okay, so my first point, there's always large numbers, is to look at the scale on the left, all right, which is, measures the flow of hires and separations in terms of thousands, thousands. So during, say, better times, the number of people that are hired in a month is of the order of 5 to 5.5 million per month. All right, but even in bad times, the shaded area corresponds to the NBR so-called recession period that we're talking about, the Great Recession. Even during that time, all right, the flow of workers being hired into new jobs is 4 million. A month, all right? So those are large flows, no matter what the state of the labor market is. That's the first observation. The second observation is this sort of flow dynamic I was talking about. When hires, the blue line's above the red line, employment rises, because you're adding workers to the stock. When the red line, as in the recession period, is higher than the blue line, separations are higher, employment falls. That's just, by definition of what we mean by employment. But you might notice that one indicator of this particular recession, of course, it was a period in which separations exceeded hires for almost the whole period. So employment was falling during the whole period. All right? Then, all right, things didn't turn around, all right, but there was a movement up in the flow rate of hires, but all the separations. I might add another striking feature of this piece is that separations and hires move together. All right, separations are high during good times, they're low during recessions. The reason for that is that a good section, about half, of the flow of people who enter employment with a new employer, because that's what we're measuring here by hires, were already employed. All right. And because quits move pro-cyclically, as in the language of economics, people tend to move from one job to another, more likely in good times and bad times these things move together. That's the reason they do. All right. So that's just the flow dynamics that I want to talk about. Now I want to talk about what's going on underneath these, what's producing the movements, all right, particularly in employment here. To make those the short story very short, this picture clearly illustrates, at least for this period, but it's true for all the post-war period in the U.S., the primary mover of employment is the level of job openings. As job openings rise, all right, unemployment duration shortens, actually, and that leads to lower unemployment and higher employment. Okay, and conversely, when job openings fall, all right, you're in recession. Okay, and now we can see in this picture, of course, what's happened to job job openings since the recession. It's come back up. Employment's risen, but it's not risen anywhere near where it was. All right, we're still short relative to the peak in employment by the employment's measured on the right-hand axis, so we're short, what is it, almost 6 million jobs. All right, which isn't a big number relative to the gross flows, but it's a big number to make up. Actually, we're short by more than that because that doesn't account for population growth. If we also account for population growth, we need another couple million over this period. All right, so, and of course the picture shows, it's been an improvement, but nothing like a return to where we were. All right, I'm not going to go into this. This is just to prove that separations don't matter that much. They matter some, but not a whole lot. All right, now I want to review what I just said in another way. Job finding probability increases with job openings, and in particular with the ratio of job openings to unemployment. This is what I'm going to call an assumption, but it's an outcome of the matching hypothesis. The more workers there are per relative to the unemployment, the longer it takes for an unemployed worker to find jobs, and that's why unemployment arises. Okay, so how fast it takes, how long it takes to find a job depends on this ratio of vacancies or job openings to unemployment. Secondly, unemployment or employment tends to the value that balances inflows and outflows, as I just said. Now, if I take those two propositions, one of which is empirical but true in the data, the second is a definition of what it means to for unemployment to be constant, then together they explain the so-called Beveridge curve, which is a negative association between job openings and unemployment. I'm going to show you a picture of it in a moment. Let me just say, did I misspell the name? No, it's not a drink. Beveridge was the name of a British economist for which this particular observation was named. And we can go into the details, but that's where it comes from. Now, given these things, and if it's job openings that drive unemployment over the business cycle, what determines job openings? Well, that's primarily a demand-side issue. All right, it depends on two variables, both of which are uncertain. All right, first of all, in this particular context, you want to think of the decision maker here as the employer. Right? After all, a job opening reflects the decision of an employer to look for a worker. When does an employer have an incentive to look for a worker? Well, since hiring a worker now is going to involve a long-term relationship ticket, over some period of time, the employer has to think about, well, what's the revenue that hiring this worker is going to generate in the future? All right. He has to think about it, but he can't. There's no market on which he can make a contract that'll tell him exactly how much return in terms of revenue he's going to get. All right, but he has to make a distinct. We have to make a decision about whether there's not going to be enough future revenue, enough, and of course subtract costs and come up with some profits. Okay, so that's the first consideration. But since this revenue is going to be distributed out in the future, a dollar in the future is not necessarily equal to a dollar now. All right? For example, you might have to borrow money to make this investment, just like any other. Therefore, he's going to have to pay an interest on that. And so he has to pay back that interest on the loan as well. All right? We economists call that the discounting. We add up the future weighted sum of future revenue, where we weight by the discount factor, how much do we discount future income because of required interest payments. And we call that the expected present value of hiring the worker. But that rate, what the interest rates are too, is in the future is uncertain. And there's an also issue about whether he can get a loan now to finance this investment. which is also, of course, depends on the state of the economy. You know, so there's a lot of uncertainty in that decision that the employer has to take into account and bear. Now, that brings us to the next point. Let's go back to what happened. What was the ultimate cause of this recession? Well, we know what it was. All right, there was a housing bubble. The housing bubble burst. All right. Now that event had impact on the labor market, both in terms of both of these variables. First of all, in response to a perceived and actual drop in household wealth, all right, households reduced consumption expenditure. They reduced expenditures on goods and services. They're in an effort, of course, to replenish their wealth, to delever their portfolio. All right, that had a direct impact on the demand for labor and on the future revenue stream that an employer could expect, namely depressed it. Secondly, there was a financial crisis, for reasons we know about, associated with it. The financial crisis, at least an initial impact, restricted lending, so it was harder to finance an investment in hiring a new worker. And it was uncertain how long that would last and so forth. Now, those were initial impacts, but I'm going to argue a little bit later, particularly the first one, continues to be extremely important and show evidence for that. In any case, these two consequences of the financial crisis reduced the expected value of a match, that is, the value of hiring a worker, fell for both reasons, generating a drop in the job finding probability, and as a consequence, when the job finding probability goes up, down rather, the length of takes to find a job goes up and unemployment rises. All right, and that's moving along the beverage curve. That's just when I say moving along the beverage curve, I'm just shorthand for that process. And there's the beverage curve, and it's very clear. What I said is perfectly consistent with it. Let me go through what all this stuff is. Take a minute. On the vertical is the job opening rate. It's essentially a ratio of how many job openings there are per employed worker. All right? That's the vertical. On the horizontal is the standard unemployment rate you're familiar with. It's published in the papers all the time. All right? So that's the two axes, unemployment and vacancies. Now, the vacancy-unemployment ratio, just for technical stuff, it corresponds to a straight line drawn through the origin. All right, the steeper that line is, the higher is the vacancy-unemployment ratio. All right, the flatter it is, the lower is the ratio. Okay? What the beverage curve itself is the level of unemployment that balances higher inflows and outflows. That's this balancing condition. Okay? So what happens is there's a high vacancy unemployment ratio, then you're up here in the upper left corner, as you were, for example, in December 2000, and up to roughly in the general area, December 07. All right? Now, what a point in this figure is an observation on what the unemployment rate was and what the vacancy rate was at a particular month. All right, so the first one's labeled December 2000. That's the point corresponding to the far upper left corner. Then subsequent months, right, are represented, of course, by movements along to different points. Now, they're connected up by color code for a reason. The blues are movements which were amounted to moving into the recession of 2001. And we moved down the beverage curve as job openings fell relative to unemployment. The recovery is represented by the red points, which go back up as job openings rose relative to unemployment. The unemployment rate fell. All right? There was some messing around. Finally, December 07, All right, it's an important date. The housing market was starting to deflate. All right, there was a as a consequence of that, there was a diminished consumption demand, and as a consequence of that, job openings started to fall. All right, job openings fell. That's the green line here, rather slowly at first. I used to have this on here, until the fall of 2008, and we all know what happened then. All right, Lehman Brothers, the financial crisis, and so forth. And then in the next few months, it tanked. All right, job openings tanked, and unemployment went up. All right, and June 2009 was the official designation as the end of the recession. That shaded area I showed before. And here's what's after. Okay. So now what I've done is I've explained what happened here up to June 2009, and there's not a whole lot of disagreement about that among economists. All pretty well agree. Now my next, the rest of the talk, is the controversial part. It's about what happened afterwards. Okay. All right. Well, you can see, obviously, all right, one thing that happened, all right, at the end of the recession, job openings went up and unemployment didn't respond. All right? Went up rather sharply. Eventually, it did respond, and this is sort of the movement back up, all right, in unemployment due to this rising job openings. However, you know, there's lots of messing around here, but the main point to illustrate, of course, is that it's a higher level than the old Beveridge curve. It's a higher level. All right, what do we make of that? Well, some have argued that we're now in another world. All right, what economists call the natural rate of unemployment, the rate at which the economy is trying to tend, has risen. Now, we're not there yet. I mean, unemployment's still moving. But there's an argument about where it's going to go. Okay. Here's a quote. A good friend of mine, a well-known, actually, theoretical econometrician in macroeconomics. Very well-known, very well-respected. But he also happens to be the president of the Minneapolis Fed in an address almost 2 years ago now. When he, based on that, all right, increase, this is what he said. What does the change in relationship between job openings and unemployment connote? He was talking specifically about that increase in job openings with no unemployment response. In a word, mismatch. So his argument is, this is just a sign of mismatch. We have a new problem. It's now more difficult to match workers that exist, that are out there with the available jobs. So that's basically his point. And that movement in the, what we're going to call in a moment, shift in the Beveridge curve is an indication of that. That's his basic argument. Of course, not all economists agree. All right? This is a quote from Christine Romer, who had just at the end, or this period of the quote, about a little over a year ago, ended her stint as chairman of Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. Another very well-known and respected economist, macroeconomist. No, she says, no. Instead, the elevated unemployment rate appears to reflect mainly cyclical factors, particularly the lingering shortfall in consumption spending and business investment. All right. So what she's saying is the same problem that caused the recession has continued to plague, all right, the recovery. That sort of sets up the debate. It doesn't resolve the debate, but I should say that these are, you might view as partisan views, so I'm going to give also Martin Feldstein's take on this of a year ago, and Martin Feldstein, for those who are too young to remember, was President Reagan's council advisor. and he's also a longtime president of the NBER, National Bureau of Economic Research, was responsible, by the way, for those deciding when a recession ends and begins. His take, he agrees, in spite of their political differences, with Christina on this. The high unemployment reflects the lack of demand rather than fundamental problems with the U.S. labor market. Okay, so I've given you the statement of what the argument is. What's the evidence? All right. Now, there's some good premium. I mean, this Beveridge curve thing, it's shifted out of that, all right, relative to 2 years ago when the first statement was made. It stayed, the unemployment stayed high relative to its position before, given the same level of job openings. So that's a case, and I'm going to use that and the model to actually make a forecast about where the unemployment rate is going to go in a minute. But there's other, you know, perfectly sensible issues here. Construction and finance industries were adversely affected. Finance has come back somewhat, construction not at all. What are you going to do with these out-of-work construction workers? They have to do something else. All right. Well, they're construction workers, but so presumably they were better at construction workers than something else. So now it's maybe more difficult to get them employed because they're going to have to accept a job that's less not as good a fit relative to their skills. All right. We have to put them in manufacturing or... maybe healthcare. There's an expanding area. All right. Well, that involves, you know, converting a construction worker to a nurse. Right. Well, it's going on. I can give you a number of examples of exactly that, of construction workers who are getting retrained to be healthcare workers. But obviously, see the point. It takes time to retrain them and make sure they fit. So. But, you know, there's large numbers, 1.3 million, but 1.3 million doesn't compare to the shortfall of, what did I say, at least 8 million jobs, all right? Another argument is housing lock. The U.S. labor market is quite flexible, and one of the mechanisms of flexibility is that if there's, unlike Europe, by the way, if there is a regional change in the relative number of jobs, then workers move. They're able to move, they're willing to move, and they do. Just as an example of that, there's an oil shale boom going on in North Dakota. Right? They just can't find enough workers for that. However, there are workers flowing in there like mad. I mean, they just haven't caught up yet with the number of jobs. So, but the housing lock issue is, okay, there's 11 million mortgages underwater. Underwater means the market price of their house is less than the mortgage outstanding. So that restricts mobility because they can't sell their house and move. And that not without taking a very large loss, which most people can't afford. All right. So that reduces the mobility. That means that it's harder to reallocate workers across regions than it was before from across jobs. Their extended unemployment benefits. The standard unemployment period in the United States in normal times is 26 weeks. It was extended immediately to 52 weeks, and this slides out of date because it was extended to 98 weeks. All right. The argument here, of course, is that if we pay unemployment benefits, we reduce the incentive for those workers to find a job. All right. That means that if they search less hard, it's going to take longer to find. There's going to see more unemployed. Recent studies, taking all of those things into account, I would say would provide evidence that no more than 1.5% of the 5 percentage point difference between 5% and 10% of, you know, unemployment rate is due to these factors. So it's not unimportant, it's potentially very important, but it doesn't explain. You know, even doesn't explain the majority of the unemployment. Let me just take you through this a little bit because I find this rather interesting. It's a little very simple exercise that a friend of mine, who happens to also be a colleague at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, did All right. The and